Hey, welcome to the Toronto Today podcast. My name's Greg Brady, host of Toronto Today. You can hear our show on the radio weekday mornings on 640 Toronto, 5:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. Podcast puts together the best highlights of the day's shows. Today is Thursday, April 25th, and we focus in on a big announcement coming out of Alliston, Ontario. Prime Minister Trudeau, Premier Ford, and a lot of Honda executives will reveal details of a $15 billion electric vehicle investment in a region where they've been making gasoline-powered cars and trucks since 1986. But first, let's start with Think Tank, where we dive into four or five of the day's top stories with panelists. We've got lawyer Karim Assad, independent MP for Spadina Fort York, Kevin Vaughn.
With responsibility and family comes tremendous scrutiny, and dangerous dogs are on the list for scrutiny. So for people who consider their dogs their little boys and girls, this is a story. There's going to be a visit potentially from city staff to owners of dogs deemed dangerous in the city of Toronto. Right now, we've got 373 dangerous dog orders in place in Toronto. I want you both to hear from City Councilor Paula Fletcher, who basically was the figurehead for this, but she got a ton of support on City Council to make sure that Torontonians are keeping their dogs in line. Here's what she said yesterday.
So let's find a way to make sure owners are really carrying out what's required of them when their dog has bitten somebody or seriously injured them previously.
Okay, so there's going to be visits, but there's a little bit of a concept, Kevin, that this is a meddling bureaucracy is the phrase I'd use. It's going to be costly. I don't doubt that something needs to be done, but dog owners are expected to sign their dog up for a 90-day obedience class. That's mandatory if their dog has been listed as dangerous. Have a sign in front of the yard. I don't know how we're going to enforce that day in, day out. And there's going to be like a living room visit or a backyard visit. This is almost Children's Aid Society stuff. How do you view this?
Well, Greg, this is an issue of safety and something that I think Torontonians expect of government. Toronto is notorious for having rules and bylaws that are never enforced. So I actually think this is the right decision in terms of keeping people safe and putting money to ensure that folks are held accountable. And you know what? I have to applaud Councillor Fletcher. It must be nice for her community to have a city councillor who actually cares about the community. Because last month, there was actually a dog attack in my community at Little Norway Park. It left a 9-year-old boy with life-altering injuries. And the owner had not only had one of those dangerous dogs, she was not complying with the previous dangerous dog order. And when this happened, it was particularly egregious because she ran away. And later, when Toronto police found her and arrested her, she was obviously charged and the dog was taken by animal control and all that sort of stuff. And now the main thing I want to focus on, though, is this public list. All right. I've been surfing this morning trying to navigate this list. Typical government fashion, not at all easy to use. We have the first three letters of the postal code. I don't know exactly where they are. I've been surfing the open data and the map. There's no points on the map. So there's actually more work the city needs to do to actually make it easier for people so we know where they are and we can take precautions.
I'll also clarify, some of the dogs on the list, Kevin, there's a dangerous occurrence listed as far back as 2017. And again, pets are our family. I know how I feel when I've lost pets previously. Kevin, some of these dogs probably aren't alive anymore.
Yeah, 100%, right? And so I think that's another thing that we need to make sure that if they're going to do this, that they're actually making sure that you're using up-to-date information so people aren't scared for the children or their families for no reason.
Karim, it's a real balancing act because you could put a sign out in front of your house and you could take your dog to obedience training. But so much of the issue is simply, are they on leash or are they off leash? We've all gone places and we sort of suss it out and think that dog's just having a great time catching a ball at the park. So if I go past that dog, he's not going to come at me. He's not going to come at my kids. But it's all about whether they're on leash or off leash sometimes.
I think that's a very important factor. And in Toronto, there are specific places to be off leash, and sometimes those rules aren't followed. I do know as well that for the dangerous dog designation, there's also a muzzling requirement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can be an important matter of prevention as well, because you're dealing with the most dangerous aspect, right? Like the teeth and the jaws. As far as this enforcement goes, I don't know what the enforcement looked like prior to this. And so is this ramping up, or is it creating something where it was very laissez-faire to begin with? And given that anyone who has this designation, there has been an incident and it's been at least investigated to some extent, and these conditions were imposed, it is the responsibility of those dog owners to follow those rules. And you know, the honor system needs to be, in order for that to work, there needs to be at least some concern or sense that there will be follow-up. And if this provides a measure of follow-up, especially in light of the various high-profile dog attacks that have happened over the last few months, I think that that's worthwhile.
I'll give this to both of you. And Karima, you're a lawyer. You're very aware of this. The delays in our court system, I was going to even call out ourselves, and I don't mind saying it's me. Like this, in late March, there was a very infamous story about an incident that happened at Little Norway Park with a child with these life-altering injuries, and we finally tracked the woman down. There'd been a still photo of her, but she's probably not going to be in front of a judge for 14, 15 months. So it's really tough with the court delays to keep full focus on what the penalties actually are, and it doesn't serve as much of a deterrent if we don't know what they are.
Yeah, there's all different aspects of our system that interact with one another, and where there's a breakdown in one part, we don't get the protection that you're otherwise hoping for. And when there are breakdowns in multiple parts of the system, that's even more unsettling.
All right, let's move it here. Kevin, anything else you want to add to this, given your, you have a jurisdiction, you have constituents that, and you had an attack in your own, in your own riding?
Yeah, I just want to touch on what you said about the delays in our justice system. That is another failure of Justin Trudeau's government. That is within their scope. And the fact that a judge had to rule and order them to do their damn job, to actually appoint judges and fill those vacancies, is an absolute shame. And they need to get their act together and appoint judges so people can get their get into the courts, get through that process, because justice delayed is justice denied.
Well said. Well, let's move it to this. And speaking of justice, it involves the Umar Zamir trial, his acquittal on Sunday, and a continuing push to get the premier of the province to apologize. For those who didn't hear it, Doug Ford was walked to his office by several media members, including our own Colin DeMello on the television side, Queen's Park Bureau Chief. Here's how Doug Ford reacted to the Zamir acquittal on Tuesday.
Do you feel like an apology is necessary, though, for that tweet?
Sorry.
Do you feel like there's an apology that's necessary, Premier, for that tweet? There are some who are saying that what you said was inappropriate in September of 2021.
You know, something at that time, I had limited information. The courts have decided, the jury decided, and you have to respect the justice system.
Do you regret it? Do you regret it?
Again, what I was saying is there's a limited amount of information I had at the point, and the courts decided. So thanks, guys.
Really dangerous stuff, in a way, Karima, isn't it? Because we could make the case, hey, Ford's got the right. He can speak his mind at the moment. He's got a right to free speech. But I think it's dangerous for politicians. I even think it's dangerous for politicians to weigh in on verdicts when they think it's gone a certain way. There's an element of respect for the justice system. We saw the chief of police in Toronto get in hot water on this front. And Karima, just the fact that he says he had limited information, but he felt he had enough information to smear an alleged criminal at the time.
Yeah, it was a pretty harsh statement that was made, given that the reasons for bail were under a publication ban. So it wasn't widely known why the judge decided the way they did, but the premier saw fit to criticize that specific decision and impugn the justice system overall. So now when he says that he respects the outcome, he respects the system, I don't think that seems disingenuous to me, because he betrayed a deep lack of respect in making those statements initially. And then you think about the fact that this government has altered the way that judges are appointed provincially. And Doug Ford himself has talked about wanting to have more like-minded judges. These are all things that compromise the integrity of our system, with having nonpartisan judges who will look at a case before them on the merits and rule appropriately, versus the politicization of court decisions. And so I think that an apology is absolutely necessary here and should be forthcoming, because even in Premier Ford's response that we heard just now, there is room to say, you know, I have learned from this, I won't do this again. And we're not getting that at all.
It's a for a politician, Kevin, of one of which you are. It's a tricky thing, because I know the media comes to you and says, "Hey, what do you think of this?" But the right thing to do is probably say it's in the hands of the courts. And until really the jury is sequestered, a politician could easily influence a case. We saw Joe Biden commenting all the time on what he hoped would happen to Derek Chauvin in the George Floyd murder. We can think what we want about that, but he shouldn't have done that. It's just a dangerous thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this is another occasion where it's important that we remind ourselves that a pillar of our justice system is innocent until proven guilty. You know, it's human to have an opinion, and I've definitely done it myself before, too, before I was elected. And so, as someone who knows a little bit about what it's like to be falsely accused, I think I've definitely made sure that I am practicing that instinct to do exactly what you said, Greg, which is like, listen, it's before the courts. It's up to the courts to now prosecute this and let justice do its thing. And we wait for the outcome before we opine, if at all.
Kevin, is he in a bit of a trap right now, though? People are calling him for him to apologize. If he apologizes, does the opposition jump on that? Or do they get more political capital from pointing out, you see, he would never apologize for this?
Yeah, I guess that's the nature of politics. I think Doug Ford seems to find a way to be able to kind of navigate these tricky issues seemingly quite well, in a way that only Doug Ford can do. And so I'll be watching to see how he manages this.
Let's move to polling for the federal government. And as an independent sitting in the House of Commons, Kevin, let's start with you. Right now, bottom line, there just hasn't been a bounce from the budget. And it's very clear the Liberals were hoping for that to be the case. And I think it's significant as well, the latest Angus Reid poll for under 40s. Kevin, we've talked about people of your generation, Karima's generation. This was meant to hit home for them, to say, we've got you. Wherever we've failed in the last 8 years, we're going to pick it up right now and allow you entry into home ownership, entry into the middle class. And it just seems fairly obvious, though it's only a poll and there's probably not an election for 17 months. It's obvious this didn't quite connect. Does that surprise you at all?
No, because Canadians can read and we can also do math, right? I'm going to zero in on one of their ludicrous, more crazy promises, which is to build 4 million homes in less than 7 years. So they expect us to believe that under Justin Trudeau's watch over the last 9 years, when the country averaged about 200,000 homes built a year, that somehow now Trudeau expects us to believe he's going to magically triple that number immediately and sustain that for almost 7 years? Give me a break. I did the math, Greg, and before I get into the math, I want to put this 4 million number into perspective. In Toronto, as of the end of 2022, we have 1.3 million homes in all of the city. And so they're promising to build the equivalent of triple of all of Toronto in less than 7 years. And that's if home construction was happening 24/7, all hours, every day of the year, which we know is not realistic. They would have to be building a house a minute. But if we realistically remove holidays and weekends and adjust for a 60-hour work week, they have to build a house every 20 seconds. You know, during this time that I've spoken, they've built like a dozen houses based on that promise. So it's ludicrous. And Canadians, especially millennials like me, I'm 34, young Canadians are tired of Justin Trudeau lying to us. Or if I'm being charitable, maybe he just didn't do the math.
But there's an onus, isn't there, on the provincial government and the municipalities to build homes as well. And there's a lot of people frustrated with the red tape surrounding the Ford government. There's a lot of people frustrated that they haven't been able to get shovels in the ground, that starts are way down in Ontario. And you've seen the data, Kevin. People are leaving Toronto. They're leaving Southern Ontario as a whole because it's too expensive. The province has an onus there.
Absolutely, but they're not the ones that are going up in front of the microphone and promising Canadians, hey, we're going to build you 4 million.
I think they're promising builds. I think they're promising to get shovels in the ground. They're saying that they are when they're not.
Yeah, but not like this, right? And what they're doing with the budget is they're sacrificing our future. Like, look at the math in terms of the amount of debt. We spend more on debt than the Canada Health transfers to provinces for healthcare. We spend more on debt than we do on national defense, almost 1.5 times, right? And ultimately, who has to pay for that debt? We do, as young Canadians. And they're screwing us over so they can hold on to power for what, another 1.5 years?
Let me ask you, Karima, where you stand on some of the polls, and I'll map them out. And when you put them into seats as opposed to percentages, shows the latest Angus Reid poll has the Conservatives at 229 seats. That's 18 more than Brian Mulroney run in a record 1984 election win. 45 for the Bloc, 35 for the NDP, 33 for the Liberals. It's unthinkable. The idea that the Liberals would have the fourth most seats, but that's where the polling lands right now, at least in this particular version of it.
Well, I think that there is a sense of fatigue with the current government that underlies this. And obviously we've come out of and are still enduring difficult times, and that's likely to, unfortunately, only get worse in the foreseeable future. So the instinct of people wanting change is not altogether surprising, especially where they feel underserved at the moment. And, you know, there has been, unfortunately, a lot of division that comes around Justin Trudeau as a personality on various issues and subjects. And so I think that there are demographics that have been alienated as a result of that. I don't know how much stock to put into a poll where there's no election that's in the horizon. But the, you know, the budget, if that was intended to sway opinion and it hasn't, it's either a matter of communication or not actually having addressed the concerns that are, you know, motivating people.
And I'll bring it to the capital gains tax and the doctors. And Kevin, you're well aware that this has landed really, really badly. In fact, the Minister of Small Business, Reshi Valdez, I thought had a disastrous interview with the CBC's David Cochran, explaining that, well, if Canadian doctors leave, we'll just replace them with foreign doctors. And people of all political stripes are shocked by that kind of language. So even though it's 8 days later and people say, the news cycle moves so fast, I think the capital gains tax, especially for this occupation where we're short and healthcare matters so much to all of us, as you'll soon find out even more when you're taking kids in with sniffles and colds and the like, it's a problem, man. And I have no idea how Valdez hasn't walked this back in the last 2 days, to be honest.
Yeah, and that's something that this government has seemed to be unable to do. They can't admit a fault. They can't admit when they've got something wrong, because this capital gains tax hurts doctors. It also hurts tradespeople, right? Many small businesses, entrepreneurs, the very people that we need to build the homes, the 4 million that they're somehow going to get us, are also hurt by this. The small business owners that are the engines of our economy across the country, where, by the way, the majority of Canadians work, are hurt by this. And so don't be surprised if you have not just doctors now, but skilled tradespeople. And I've heard from so many, I was a tech entrepreneur before I was elected. I've heard from so many people that are furious with this. What incentive do they have to take risk, to risk everything, to build a business? Part of the deal is, hey, you take the risk and you get the reward, and now they're being punished for being successful. Why would you build a business in Canada now?
Well, and Karima, there's a political philosophy. Daryl Bricker, the pollster, quoted Ronald Reagan about it, and the quote's pretty simple. In politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. You got to keep it simple for the audience. You got to keep it simple, trust me, for the media, and you got to keep it simple for the people who might vote for you someday. So there's been a ton of almost chalk talk about this capital gains tax, and it looks like it looks like you're trying too hard sometimes.
Well, there's a balance between, you know, not talking down to people and underestimating their intelligence, but also getting lost in the granular details that not everyone has the time to absorb or even the capacity to absorb. So I think, you know, there's not much I agree with as far as Ronald Reagan is concerned, but I think that that's a fairly accurate statement and slogan. And the Pierre Poilievre and the opposition are quite successful at catchy slogans and domineering a narrative.
Hey, we're out of time. Appreciate you both being on this morning. Kevin, Karima, thanks so much.
Thank you,
Greg.
That was Think Tank. That airs every weekday at 7:35 and goes right up to the 8 o'clock news with Dave Bradley. Our next guest, Flavio Volpe. He's president of the Automotive Manufacturers Association of Canada. He'll tell us how important this $15 billion EV investment from Honda is for not just Ontario's auto industry, but across the country, where EV sales, at least compared to the United States, have been sluggish. A couple reasons why that is. We'll talk to Flavio about these things.
You called it a big bet on the part of Honda. Is it a bet on us in Ontario, or is it a bet on electric vehicles, period, or a bit of both?
It's a bit of both, and I think Honda and Toyota have been rather sanguine about what electrification looks like. You know, we've seen a lot of analysts criticize the two of them, say, well, they're not in fast enough or hard enough. Their predictions are that instead of 100% electrification by 2035, it might be 35 or 40%. But their bet is 80% of the cars that we make in Canada, so about 1.6 of the 2 million cars we make a year, end up for export in the U.S. The U.S. market is 17 million cars a year. So if 35, 40% of that electrified, we're talking about 7 million cars a year. And so Honda's making a bet that they can serve that market with electric Hondas from Alliston. And I think that's an important distinction for all of us to understand. They could have done that in Ohio, where they have a massive campus. But they have a more stable and better educated workforce here. And we've got that supply chain that can't be easily dismissed to get the stuff out of the ground. But almost as important, got 120,000 people who are making components that make up these Hondas.
I think that's exciting to hear. And the education of the workforce is one thing, because I think we obviously would make the case, and it's been this way since, well, not just NAFTA, but when the free trade agreement was signed in 88, you and I were a lot younger then, but people worried considerably that every auto manufacturer would take their business to Mexico, let alone the United States. We wouldn't have many places like Alliston or like what we've had in Ingersoll and some other plants before. Why have we been able to stabilize this, even though labor might be cheaper somewhere else?
Well, it's a couple things. Number one, places like Alliston provide stability. This is the largest single employment site for any single employer in the country. And so you build a campus, you build the capabilities in the spot, and people in Canada in manufacturing stay with their companies. They have a term, an average term of 120 months, where in other places you're looking for new people, you know, in some cases every few months. The other thing is that, look, labor is an important cost component of a vehicle, but it might be your all-in cost might be $50 an hour times, you know, 20 hours to make a car. That's $1,000 of a $25,000 or $50,000 car. We were worried in the past that people would run to go and pay somebody else $3 or $6 an hour, but it's just not a big enough component of a car to take a risk as a car company to go someplace where your conditions are less stable.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Obviously, this is also about jobs, and this is about younger people getting jobs. And the one thing the auto industry, Flavio, I think we'd make the case, has provided is it's often been a career and not a job. No one's promised a career no matter what they do. You and I sure aren't. So But the bottom line is we can start young people doing this, and hopefully it is something that lasts 10, 15 years instead of just two or three. Is that the hope for a moment like this today?
Yeah, you're hitting the core of what makes this exciting, is that if you're going to convince somebody who's 18 or 20 or 25 to go into automotive, the last 10, 15 years or so, you know, people have been worried about their job. They've been worried that that pickup truck that we're making or that SUV that we're making isn't going to be renewed in 5 or 6 years. And so as much as you can pay people, they're always looking for something else that's going to be a little bit more stable, where you can try to start a life on, a family or whatever. Because we're electrifying, and because these are forward investments by the world's biggest companies and not startups, you know, you can convince people to say, look, they're going to hybridize, they're going to electrify, they're going to do fuel cell, they're going to do a connected autonomous vehicles from these these high voltage platforms. Think of this is the global lead plant for Honda in this space. You get a job there if you want to. You can think of yourself in the various stages of your life and your career. And I think we'll do two things. We'll give people more confidence, but also be able to recruit the best people to help reinforce this cycle of investment. And that 20 years from now, when Honda makes its next $40 billion investment, it'll be because they've been here for 60 years and it's always worked out.
What kind of promise do you want to see, or at least a pledge, if that's less than a promise, that these jobs are for Canadians, that these jobs are for young men and women that live here in Ontario? I'm sure you've seen the reports in Windsor that there's concern. Even the mayor has weighed in on what Stellantis has done, bringing in workers from overseas. It's thought they know the setup better. Eventually, they'll do what they need to do. They'll get paid. They'll go back, and those jobs will be Canadian. But this is part and parcel. There's no point in doing this if Canadians aren't employed in a way.
Yeah, you're right, and I think the government is learning every time they do these partnerships. In that case, you know, this is very specialized equipment that gets set up, and you're buying it from companies that have to warranty them. So they turn around and say, look, we've got to bring in our specialists to set them up. Otherwise, we're going to void those warranties. We've learned, and I know that this has been part of the discussions of the latest rounds, including this one, but also other ones that are on tap here, that we want to see written commitments and covenants to these are, especially in the mid to long term, Canadian jobs, period. Otherwise, you know, you don't qualify for some of the trailing subsidies. I know, even in the Stellantis case, that long-term, like meaning after the setup in the next year or so, those are all local jobs.
Yeah.
The Korean specialists that showed up there are there for warranty reasons. But, you know, hey, listen, if we had done enough advanced planning, we probably could have found a few hundred Canadians who do that business to do some of that warrantable installation work too.
All right. Safe travels to Alliston, and thanks for the time this morning. I always appreciate your contributions.
Anytime. Thank you.
Thanks to Flavio Volpe for joining us. Now, Mary Ormsby, a really well-known name in the sports journalism world for decades in Toronto. She got time with Ben Johnson, the former sprinter who won the gold medal in Seoul and quickly had the gold medal taken away in Seoul for a positive steroid test. She's written a book with a lot of access to Ben Johnson called World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. Here's that conversation. Well, you spent a lot of time with Ben. There's been a lot written about Ben, said about Ben, TV documentaries about Ben. But he has not, I don't think he sat down with any journalist and told his story or spent as much time with anybody as he has with you for this book. So I think he's still fascinating to Canadians, isn't he?
You know, you're correct. I think over time, as Canadians learned that obviously that was an enormous catastrophic scandal for Ben at the time for failing that test by having anabolic steroids in the system. You know, the community at large has learned more about it was rampant in the 80s, the use of performance enhancing drugs, and people have been picked off in track and field and other sports for doing the same thing in the years and decades since, right up to this year, in fact. So doping has been a problem since then, and the public has learned more. And I think when you tap into the Canadian psyche, talking about Ben Johnson, I think there's a bit of a sympathy there for him and a wonder, like, wow, why was he the only guy singled out back in 1988? So I think that's part of the, you know, the uptake for his story. Like, wow, what really happened?
Well, I think you bring up such a good point, and I bet you there's parents listening and fans of sport, Mary, that listen and think he is 26 and a half years old when Seoul happened. And I would say I don't think he handled everything right then or in the aftermath or for years to come. But we didn't talk about the mental health journey of an athlete back then. I can only imagine what his world was like. We're all in on listening to Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka and many other male and female athletes who struggle with the everyday pressure. We didn't give that much thought. We really did vilify Ben as Canadians back then, didn't we?
Yeah, that's an excellent point because, you know, obviously I'm not a doctor or, you know, a psychiatrist or anything like that. And this was before the internet even. But Ben, you know, like a lot of athletes now, he was surrounded by an entourage at the time. But when this broke, everybody scattered and everybody lawyered up. And, you know, the Canadian government came down immediately and said, you're banned for life. So there's this international shaming of a guy, 26 and a half, but still, you know, like a lot of athletes, a little bit immature about how life works. He felt like really the pressure must have been just so traumatic. And he was in shock because he knew what it meant. And he compounded everything by lying. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah.
He said, I didn't do it. And he said, I didn't do it for a very long time. And it wasn't until a Royal Commission and he testified under oath that, yes, I actually was using steroids. But, you know, I still don't know why he's upright. He fought through it. He's been resilient because it would have been absolutely crushing. And I think it broke him many times along the way. It was just soul destroying, not to use that bad pun, but he fought back. And his faith was a big part of it. His mother, to whom he was devoted, was a big part of, you know, pulling him out of all those really, really dark places. And now he turns to God as a way to be a touchstone in his life.
Mary Ormsby is our guest. The book is World's Fastest Man, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. What do you learn about sitting down with him that may even surprise you about who he is and what makes him tick, Mary?
That he, you know, he was painted so long as a cartoon character, a one-dimensional sports villain with no redeemable qualities. That was just how he was framed in media. And at the time, and because he wasn't someone who's, you know, spoke up a lot for himself, he didn't really advocate for himself. That unfortunate definition of a human being was constant for a long time. But he's a very deep thinker. He's a very spiritual guy. He's got lots of thoughts and feelings about a lot of things. And though he's a quiet man, he keeps an eye on the pulse of the track. And, you know, at this point, I didn't know he would want to do this, but he's going to move back to Jamaica full-time at some point very soon and just visit Canada. He feels more comfortable back home, and that's where he's going to be because that was obviously where he was born and came to Canada as a 14-year-old boy.
I'd recommend the book for so many reasons. And I'm Ben, like I said, I'm a teenager, so that's right in my wheelhouse. And we always remember stuff in pop culture and news when we were that age. He was named Newsmaker of the Year by Canadian Press in 1988, and he was that. How familiar with his story do you think people under 35 are? Because, again, we know the people that have been prominent. Donovan Bailey goes and wins the gold medal in Atlanta 8 years later, and it's like, well, that puts the scandal behind, and now it's all happy times for Canadian track.
Yeah, I think partly because Ben, the chapter on Ben was sort of open and shut in Seoul, and, you know, he got on with his life a little bit, and then unfortunately tested positive a second time, and that led to a lifetime ban. So you're right. He's kind of like off the landscape, even if you're a sports fan. That's why this book, I think, is important from the perspective of what happened to Ben, you know, personally. And then we sort of identify some procedural fairness issues with a hearing in Seoul. Might he have kept his medal if he'd had a better defense, that sort of thing. But I think Canadians would be fascinated by this particular figure because he is compelling. You know, we ask in the book, is it possible to railroad a guilty guy just because of what happened to Seoul and how he was treated? So I think that if you're a sports fan, if you're a Canadian, or even if you're an international person, a young person who wants to know more about this incredible, you know, sort of flashpoint in Olympic history, You want to read about Ben.
If you can do it in 45 seconds, what's his theory about what happened in Seoul? It's not the conventional theory we thought at the time, that he just like ran right up to the deadline and was on the stuff way too late.
He believes a stranger in the doping control room, where you go after you win your medal, sat beside him, chatted him up, and surreptitiously put steroid pills in his beer. That's the sabotage theory. Ben believed it back then. It was debunked. It has been debunked since. But he still believes in his heart that he was sabotaged in the doping control room by an American stranger.
We need the Netflix dramatic version of this over four or five episodes. We haven't got that yet. We'll settle for the book. You're great at what you do, so I think people are going to be really excited to read this. Thanks for the time, Mary.
Thank you so much, Greg. Have a great day.
Some really interesting stuff on Ben Johnson. Always enigmatic. We're never quite sure what's real and what's not with Ben Johnson. That sort of sums it up. That was Mary Ormsby. That's a wrap for this Toronto Today podcast. Catch us live Monday to Friday, 5:30 to 9. You can hear us on the radio or stream us at 640 Toronto and with the Radio Player Canada app. We'll have a recap tomorrow right here where you got this podcast of the day's best talkers on the Toronto Today podcast. Have a great day.